Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're grateful that you're with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up a little bit later in today's show, Prairie Public CEO John Harris sits down with North Dakota Governor Kelly Armstrong. Topics include property tax relief, department budgets, the state hospital, and some of the bills that were vetoed by the governor, and we'll air their conversation, which was an excerpt from the Prairie Pulse television show. And we begin Main Street today by discussing trauma-informed care, which is an approach to healthcare, education, social services, and other fields that recognizes the widespread impact of trauma and seeks to create environments that promote healing and avoid re-traumatization. With me to discuss is Heather Simonich. Heather is a licensed professional counselor, and she currently serves as an assistant dean of students and director of the Center for Holistic Health at Concordia College. Heather, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks, Craig. Happy to be here.
Heather, we're visiting with you in front of an event at Concordia College that's scheduled for Wednesday, May 21st from 8:30 to 11:30 on trauma-informed care, fostering healing through best practices training. You're the leader for this. Heather, first tell us in a more complete way what trauma-informed care is, and then we'll get into what you hope to chat about on May 21st.
Sure. Trauma-informed care is really an approach to how we go about our work, serving the clients or customers, whatever it might be that we're working with, that takes into account our understanding about how early adversity or traumatic life experiences in childhood impact both the developing child and the adult. And so there are strategies that are really supportive in helping individuals who have been impacted by these types of early life experiences in overcoming the kind of tragedy that could result if not responded to with effective intervention, or adults or service systems that understand how those experiences have impacted their development and functioning. And gratefully, we know a lot more about that through science, especially the area of neurobiology, or essentially brain development science, that helps us really understand what happens to the developing brains of children when repeated exposure to scary life events occurs too often or for too long of periods of time during their childhood.
Why is it important then for healthcare, for education, and community services to pay attention to what trauma-informed care is?
Critically important for those working in those fields, but I would say even beyond. I think this is a conversation that everyone should be concerned about, because for most of us, we're all interacting with other humans, other adults who were once children that may have had these types of experiences. And it's critically important for people to understand that sometimes the challenging or difficult behaviors that we might see in each other, whether it's children or adults, has something to do with early childhood experiences and how that's impacted them. Those behaviors, whether maybe it's an employee that repeatedly shows up late or that is unnecessarily kind of closed off or walled off and not engaging with other coworkers or with you as a supervisor, us understanding that sometimes the resulting behavior is actually a really adaptive response to maybe earlier experiences in their life that are now getting in the way, but undoubtedly at some point in time in their life served a really helpful protective function in helping them adapt and cope and be resilient and successful. And so our job is healthcare providers, social workers, business owners, educators is to help them understand how to do it differently. So it's really an approach of recognizing, you know, what's happened to folks versus what's wrong, and approaching all of that with an effort to teach, knowing that if it's a matter of not a matter of kind of willing them, it's more about building skills. So not about effort or desire to be adaptive and responsive and effective in their environments, but more about needing some support to build new skills to do it differently in a way that's more adaptive.
Heather, I'm thinking about this in the context of a business owner. And yeah. Now, as a business owner, okay, I recognize these behaviors, but I also recognize the need to have a line between someone's personal history and that which I've hired he or she to do for me. And
yeah.
How can I cross that line to be helpful in the way that you describe?
Excellent, excellent question. And so I think when people hear about trauma-informed care, they often think, oh my, I wonder if this woman's telling us we should really dive deep into understanding exactly what's happened to our employees, our clients, our patients. And to be effective, we have to know that history in great detail in a way that's exactly like you said, Craig, in a lot of fields, crossing a boundary that's not necessary. And that's why when we're talking about trauma-informed care, we're really talking about a universal approach to this. That is, you know, just like a phlebotomist that puts on rubber gloves to draw someone's blood, you do that because you don't know their history. You don't know who could have HIV, AIDS, or Hep C. So you put those rubber gloves on with everyone you draw blood from, because we can't tell by looking at people who might have a contagious disease like that. And so with trauma, it's the same idea. We don't have to know people's detailed histories. What we have to know is that this is something, these experiences are something that really can impact humans. So you approach everybody as if this may be their story. And in doing so, we cause no harm to those who don't have these types of histories, but we can engage with, adopt, learn new best practices, many of which are already established in our fields, that help those particularly affected by this situation that is childhood trauma really thrive and be resilient. So maybe that's helpful in understanding how you manage that boundary.
You've listed several vocations. Who is it that you hope comes to this free training on May 21st? Which includes, by the way, a free breakfast, I see.
Yes. Yes, it does. So for me, while we're targeting those working maybe more intimately or directly with populations that have maybe a higher likelihood of these types of experiences, like educators, healthcare workers, social workers, mental health counselors, as I said early in the interview, I just don't know that there's a field that you can work in where this wouldn't be helpful. And if for nothing else, your own family. It's not unlikely that even if you're in some sort of industry that maybe doesn't touch this as closely, that you might have a cousin or a daughter-in-law that has a history like this. And it's important for you to have this understanding in your approach to your relationship with those individuals that you care most about as well.
Heather, tell us about your background.
Well, kind of an interesting background. Certainly my background is in counseling. So I'm a licensed mental health counselor by training. Right after graduate school, I spent about 15 years in research. So in clinical research in the areas of both eating disorders and childhood trauma. So I come from a background that's really based on science. And I believe our children and those impacted by these types of experiences deserve us to use science to guide our practices in the same way we would use science to guide our practice in treating a childhood cancer. A great appreciation for science and research in that I was working in clinical research for about 15 years and then moved to an operations director role for a large child and family service center, largely serving children and families impacted by social services, the child protection system. Big service areas for us were foster care and then supporting their mental health while in the foster care system. Then recently, just most recently in the last 2 years, have served in this role at Concordia, my alma mater. Felt a strong calling to come back and lead some of this work around wellness at a time post-COVID that we knew a lot of young adults were struggling with their mental health. So here I am at Concordia leading work around student wellness.
You talked about a science-based perspective. Without getting too nerdy for us, Heather, if you can,
yeah.
The neural biology of trauma. And why is it important for laymen like me to understand how trauma affects the brain when we're working with various individuals, whether they be our students, subordinates, our colleagues?
Yeah. Well, I'll do my best to be real, real, real simple. I guess to give a shout out first to all the researchers that have really helped us understand this better. I think the reason the research matters is for, well, several reasons. But first and foremost, I think for a long time, many of us in these fields, kind of in the trenches, closest to those that are most impacted by adversity and trauma in childhood, we knew this is not a good thing. We knew that it impacted people and it carried often with them for years and years to come. But it really wasn't until the last 10, 15 years that we could explain this from a neurobiological standpoint that people started to take note, that no longer people could say, oh yeah, they better go see a counselor or let's send that person to psych. Now it's like, wow, this changes the developing brains of our children, the brains that our educators rely on to have ready learners every day at school. You know, and all of a sudden it maybe is heard a little bit differently when you can tie it to actual science in that way. I mean, in a nutshell, what I would say is these types of experience wire a person's brain to just be hyperactive, kind of hypersensitive to scary life events. And I'll use my kid language, you know, when I'm working with children. The brain was not meant, our bodies were not meant to be constantly exposed to life-threatening experiences throughout our childhood. Certainly, when we see a bear in the woods, there's a natural biological stress response system that is fight, flight, or freeze. Most people are familiar with that idea. And that system is meant to keep us alive. And it fires real quickly. And when you see a bear in the woods, you're not using the rational, reasonable, sophisticated part of your brain. Your brain is on a real tight circuit to react and keep you alive. Unfortunately, when children are exposed to frightening life events early in life, too long or too often, those stress hormones that are secreted during that hyper kind of fight, flight, or freeze response end up being somewhat toxic or poisonous to the developing brain. When you have that cortisol, norepinephrine, adrenaline circulating too often for too long in a developing brain, we now know that that can really derail what would be healthy, normal childhood brain development. And there's several reasons that that happens, but at the end of the day, our system's response to the science has to be recognizing that you've wired a brain, the developing brain in this child, a bit differently. One that's on guard for constant danger, quick to react to threats, sees a lot of things as dangerous or threatening that are not necessarily threatening. And so when that happens, the brain is hypersensitive to quickly kicking in to fight, flight, or freeze in a way that's really unnecessary sometimes, given the situation, but is incredibly adaptive if you've spent a lifetime trying to in a real way that's necessary for survival, detect danger and threat and keep yourself safe.
My guest is Heather Simonich. She has over 20 years of experience in mental health research, therapy, and advocacy. She's leading a special training at Concordia College, sponsored by the college and Clay County Public Health. The training is titled Trauma-Informed Care, Fostering Healing Through Best Practices, and it's on Wednesday, May 21st, from 8:30 in the morning till 11:30 in the morning at Concordia College. It is free to attend, and as I said earlier, includes a complimentary breakfast. Heather, in hearing you talk about the science and the neurobiology, it struck me that older gray hairs like me and younger children of today, the students that you interact with, are equally likely to probably have experienced childhood trauma. But they are younger. I'm older. And that affects us maybe in different ways, Heather. And does your training talk about the age differences with people who you are working with or who we are interacting with on a daily basis?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's often posed for when I'm training. A lot of times the adults in the audience will come up and share, wow, this is me. You're explaining me as a kid. I've learned a lot about myself here. This was my story. And I think what's really important to take away from this conversation, because it can be really daunting, it can be uncomfortable for people to sit with. It's deeply personal. But there is such a strong message of hope in the training and the work that I do and from the science. That is, when we create, no matter what age, when we create safe, supportive communities, schools, churches, and wrap supportive, loving adults around people where connections are strong, there's no reason to think that there isn't healing that occurs in a way that's really adaptive and helpful and possible. I always say the brain is so amazing, right? It's malleable, it's adaptive, it's flexible, and it adapts to its environment to keep you healthy as best it can. And so this isn't about damaged brains in young people. This is about brains that were really adaptive to that environment and now have the potential, when surrounded in different places and supportive environments, or when that trauma, that stressor is removed, to really heal and thrive and kind of rewire and adapt to that environment. So I think potential for healing is strong regardless somebody's age. And we also know the earlier we can intervene, the earlier we can help secure a safe, nurturing environment for children to be reared in, the stronger the potential for healing and resilience and less negative health impacts, social impacts down the road.
For someone who's my age, whose childhood was 60 years ago, I think maybe there are listeners who are right now thinking, ah, come on, my childhood, Heather, 60 years ago, doesn't have anything to do with the way I'm living my life today. Yet in some literature I've read, in fact, it might.
Yeah, it might. You're right. And it may not. Children, people, right, are naturally quite resilient without targeted intervention. They seem to adapt and do well by and large. We say it's about a third of children that experience traumatic events in childhood that actually it's only about a third that need targeted intervention, like someone like me, like a mental health therapist, really targeting the trauma. The other two thirds of folks tend to do pretty well. And so it's possible that people have had these experiences and they've been fortunate to be surrounded by safe, supportive people that have helped them overcome those experiences. But that's not everyone's story. And we all know people that we maybe heard of with both types of stories, lots of adversity. They've overcome it. They've done remarkably well. And some who haven't had as positive about outcomes in terms of struggling with addiction or mental health or difficulty with forming relationships or keeping steady employment. And so I think that's the challenge with trauma, is it impacts everybody differently. And so there isn't a simple way to detect it or to know how to respond, but there are some really fundamental best practices that we all can do. And for those that bubble up that need more support, then we have a different pathway to help them overcome that.
Heather, is it your finding that people who experience trauma in present day has then that trauma blow up, if you will, and then bring back in childhood events and other things that then exacerbate what just happened in the last week, the loss of a loved one, perhaps, learning that a friend has a significant illness or some other sort of trauma, all of a sudden takes us back to a time when we were really young, experienced trauma, and now we're reacting in ways that we never have before. Is that an experience that you see?
So that's another really good point, that somebody in their 50s, 60s, 70s might be thinking, this has never really, really impacted me in a way that's been really profound, until something happens that brings you back to that spot of tremendous fear or loss. You know, for some of our kids, it's if they've experienced sexual abuse early in childhood and they get into their first adult sexual relationship and all of a sudden those feelings come back unexpectedly, or they go give birth to their first child. Or to your point, you lose your spouse. And now all of a sudden, the death of your mom, who died by suicide when you were 12, comes racing back in ways that you never expected. And you can't quite figure out why you've got such big, complicated feelings that seem different than a grief pattern of somebody losing their spouse. But it's tied up with your own stuff of loss of a fundamental kind of connection and relationship. So you're right. It can catch you by surprise.
Heather, when I first saw this press release from Concordia College about this event, I was thinking, okay, some maybe first responders, some teachers, some healthcare workers are going to come to this. Are you advocating that maybe the public can experience this as well? Because we all, as you said earlier, work with folks.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's definitely open to the public. We welcome anybody that's interested in learning, because I just don't think there's anyone that it wouldn't apply to. I don't think there's anyone that would sit in that training and say, this is not relevant to me. Whether it's their own life experiences, somebody that they care deeply about, or their employees, or the people that they're serving in whatever industry they're working. Inevitably, childhood trauma is common. You are surrounded every single day in our communities by people who have these experiences.
Finally, Heather, when people walk away from the training, give us one or two things you really hope that they can take with them.
Wow, where do I begin? I think the biggest thing I take away is sometimes people feel, number one, I'm not sure I can make a difference. And so my first message would be, this is going to take all of us. And it doesn't matter if you answer the phone at your place of employment, if you greet people when they come in the door, if you're a teacher, if you're a foster parent, everyone can have an impact. And you'd be surprised. I mean, after sitting with many individuals impacted by these types of experiences over the years, how many people will cite one encouraging comment or one teacher who wrote a special note at the bottom of their personal essay that they hold with them, or that police officer that said to the boy that called 911 when there was a big domestic incident at his house, and I said, what else did people tell you? He was really struggling with the idea that it was his fault and that he wrecked his family because he called 911. And he said, well, there was that police officer. When he shined the flashlight under the bed to get me to come out, he told me, you can come out. You're the bravest boy I've ever met. And that was really the foundation of our work, our trauma work together in our counseling sessions. So big or small, we all can have an impact. And so I do think the one thing I'd say is this is all of us together. And number two, I would say at the end of the day, this is about creating spaces where people can feel emotionally safe. And that might sound like a lot to digest at first, but it's if you think about yourself and you think about who you show up to work for every day in your place of work, we all want to show up where we feel like we're safe. We're not going to show up to erratic behavior or get yelled at one day and then told we're the best employee the next day, but consistent, calm, safe environments where we feel safe. It spurs innovation and creativity when people feel safe. So things that help people feel safe are nonverbal communication, treating each other with kindness. I mean, these are simple, fundamental basics of interpersonal skills that we don't realize are connected to helping people with trauma. Helping people know what's going to happen next. Predictability helps us feel safe. Sharing control, offering choices, all of those things in your interactions with humans help them feel safe, which at the end of the day helps keep an overactive stress response system from firing unnecessarily. And when that happens, we don't do our best work. We don't behave in the best ways possible when we're in fight, flight, or freeze. So if we can keep people in those types of spaces, all of us will do better, particularly those who have histories of childhood trauma.
My guest today on Main Street has been Heather Simonich. She is leading a special workshop at Concordia College, sponsored by the college and Clay County Public Health. It's on trauma-informed care, fostering healing through best practices. The training is on Wednesday, May 21st, from 8:30 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. It includes a complimentary breakfast. It is at Concordia College in the Knutson Center, and there is more information available about the training at the website of Concordia College. Heather, it's been a pleasure. Best wishes with your training.
Thanks so much. I appreciate your interest.
Thanks for joining us on Main Street. Still to come on Main Street, North Dakota Governor Kelly Armstrong sits down with Prairie Public CEO John Harris. They'll talk about property tax relief, department budgets, the state hospital, and bills that the governor vetoed, plus a whole lot more. That's ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The show continues with Prairie Public's CEO John Harris, who sat down recently with North Dakota Governor Kelly Armstrong. The two interviewed for a segment that aired on the Prairie Pulse television show, and they talked about a lot of things, including property tax relief, departmental budgets, the state hospital, and some of the bills the governor vetoed.
We're proud today to have the governor of the great state of North Dakota, Governor Kelly Armstrong. Governor Armstrong, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You just finished your first legislative session. Maybe give us an overview of how you think it went from your perspective.
Well, as somebody who's served in two different legislative bodies, I have tremendous amount of respect for what my friends and colleagues do down the hall of the Capitol. So North Dakota obviously is unique, 80 days every 2 years. I think it's a great system. Every member of the legislature gets to move back home and has to spend time with their constituents in their districts. I think it's close, about as close to what our founding fathers thought a legislative body should be as that currently exists. We got some wins. I think there were some missed opportunities. Kind of like every legislative session. We're really proud of the property tax bill that passed. We're proud of this bell-to-bell cell phone ban through K through 12. We dealt with capacity to move natural gas out of the Bakken, both for the oil and gas industry and for, you know, industry value-added ag along that line. And we created a new cabinet position for a cabinet member of recovery and reentry, took some steps to solve the jail overcrowding crisis. And, you know, we got a lot done, and I thought it was a great session.
Property taxes were a major priority for you in particular. I think it was one. Can maybe you walk us through how that went and what North Dakotans will see and what benefits they'll have now with what passed?
The first 5 minutes of my state of the state, we laid out a plan for $1,550 property tax relief to primary residents, 3% cap on local property tax budgets, use legacy fund earning streams to pay this. On the last day of the session, we got $1,600 in primary residential relief, 3% cap on local municipalities' property tax budgets, and we're going to use legacy fund earnings to do it. So the process was long and winding to kind of, I said it's a little like running the 400 meter. You go in a big circle and you end up right where you started, but the bill came through. I think it's going to work. What people are going to see is $1,600 in lower property taxes on their primary residence. So 3 out of 4 houses will qualify. 1 out of 3 will pay no property tax in the next biennium. Our hope and our plan and our advocacy is going to be to continue to have that legacy fund earning stream grow so that we can continue to deliver more tax relief combined with the 3% cap on local budgets. The relief will grow faster than the actual property tax bill, which is what I think North Dakota residents want. The reason we chose primary residence was twofold. One, we wanted to be able to deliver enough significant relief that people actually saw it. And two, if you're using legacy fund earnings, we wanted to make sure it was going to North Dakota citizens. And if you have a primary residence in North Dakota, you live in North Dakota.
Outside of the property tax relief, what is your view on how legacy fund money should be spent? I mean, you're using it this way, so...
Yeah, I mean, I think earnings for this is a direct benefit to North Dakota citizens. It's important to recognize we are not touching the principal. We are doing more things with legacy fund earnings to deal with road infrastructure. I think that people really care. It doesn't matter if it's a highway, a state highway, interstate highway, county road, township road. You know, a lot of our economic activity in this state comes from places that aren't in Bismarck, Fargo, Grand Forks, whether it's ag or energy. And so using those legacy fund earnings and to deliver back to North Dakota citizens, I think is one, what the legacy fund was intended for, and two, gives you an opportunity to get people to buy into that fund and protect it.
You vetoed a controversial library oversight bill. Can you talk about what this bill would have done and why you vetoed it?
Yeah, I mean, first we'll start with the process. This gave more process power to somebody complaining about a book than we have anywhere else in the Century Code, more than, you know, a criminal victim, more than a civil plaintiff, more than a civil defendant, more than a fired state employee. I actually said that in my letter. It created a 3-tiered system for anybody. By the way, that anybody doesn't have to be a North Dakota citizen. Anybody can complain about any book and force 3 different procedural things to happen, all the way up to a state's attorney in whatever county you live in being forced to require a 60-day or within 60 days to write a state's attorney opinion. So the framework for how to enforce this bill, quite frankly, didn't make any sense. And the other answer is it's not just I think most reasonable people can look at a book and be like, that book, probably not absolutely not appropriate for six-year-olds. But it's not only those books that can be brought into that fight, and that's really important. Obscenity is pretty easy to define. The problem is everybody defines it a little differently.
You also vetoed the private school voucher bill. What about what that was and why did you veto it?
I think that's one of the missed opportunities this legislative session. There were two different school choice bills. One was in the Senate, one was in the House. It's almost the exact opposite of the bell-to-bell cell phone ban in that the advocacy groups never really got on the same pages. They never combined the best parts of both of those bills, which I think are needed to have a real viable plan. This bill was only for private schools, would have only affected essentially the largest seven communities in North Dakota. The other bill was more of an ESA account that affected all kids in the K-12 education. There were really good things in both of those bills, but I just really believed you needed them both. Otherwise, you have part of a bill. We get one shot to do this right. And it's a controversial topic. It'll be a controversial topic whenever we move a policy through. So I think, just trying to get some, this is not one of those places where you just try and get something passed and worry about it the next time, because we have to worry about referrals. We have to worry about all of that. And school choice needs to be able to be for all schools and all districts in North Dakota.
Okay. Well, let's move on to some of the overall budgets that you submitted and how they came out. Let's start off with the human services part of it.
So the human service budget has a little less than I think both the governor's proposal, but one of the things I'm more excited about probably, it's kind of in the grind, is we've created a couple hybrid committees up at the legislature, which we worked with legislative leaders on. One is on cash management for the state of North Dakota. The other one is on efficiency. You know, I came into the legislature in 2013. Prior to that, we didn't really have enough money to adequately fund human services, K-12, higher ed. The legacy fund of the oil book. But the flip side of that is, since in the last 15 years, every one of these agencies' budgets has grown exponentially. And it's time to take a look and start looking at them and figuring out what works in those agencies that's under-resourced that we should divert more resources to. What programs have we stood up in those agencies that have never worked? Because I don't want to give those programs less money. I want to give those programs no money. And then I want to figure out how we take the money that we're spending on a lot of these things were good ideas, right? We were underfunded traditionally, trying to do some different things, but I would rather take the money towards programs that work. And the other answer is North Dakota's been blessed for 20 years, but our government has grown a lot over the last 20 years. And it's needed to, but we can't sustain that growth. So it's time to get back to our core functions and go forward. Human service budget's going to be fine. We're going to be able to deliver the services. We want to figure out how we can do some of those things significantly more efficiently and have more of your taxpayer dollar going to the service provided, and also make sure we're providing the service as quickly and responsibly as we can.
You mentioned higher education there just briefly. How did higher education fare in this session?
Higher ed did fine. I think the longer conversation with higher ed, the budget came out. It's one of the last budgets to work through. Obviously, we have our two research institutions in the Red River Valley, and we have schools all across the state. It's our number one workforce recruitment tool. And we have to continue to do that. I think the longer term conversation about higher ed is more strategic and important, because demographically, no matter how great our institutions are, 20 years from now, they're going to have less students in there than they do now. And we do a per pupil tuition model, and we chase those tuition numbers. But we really have to start having a focus on how we're delivering the education in North Dakota for the jobs that are open in North Dakota, and how we get to keep our high school sophomores, our high school juniors, to go to a North Dakota school and stay in North Dakota when they're done.
Well, another subject that was somewhat controversial, I guess, the state hospital.
We recommended $300 million in our budget. I think the original price was $345 million. The Senate moved it down to like $275 or $285, and it came out with $200 million and $100 million line of credit, which is sufficient to do. That process really happened mostly last legislative session. We need a new state hospital. I think everybody understands it's not a want, it's a need. The question is how do you build it? How do you make sure you have the capacity? How do you responsibly steward taxpayer money? And one of the things that we try to really point out to everybody is the difference between $300 million and $285 million isn't huge, unless the $285 million requires you to wait 2 years to build it because you have to redesign the whole thing. And then when you go out and get bids 2 years from now, I mean, the cost savings have to be so significant at this point that you can do it and you don't lose the opportunity cost by waiting 2 years to build. Because with these type of projects, every month you wait to build is somewhere between $500 and $1 million a month that you can just see an added cost. So we're excited about State Hospital. I think it'll be, I mean, it's a long time coming, and it will give us an opportunity to treat those people in our state that actually, I mean, some of the most vulnerable people in our state that actually need the services that North Dakota provides.
You mentioned the bell-to-bell cell phone bill and its ban. What does that look like, and when will it go into effect?
It'll go into effect next school year. That was a really unique and interesting, I think, good example of how a legislative process works. We had supported Representative Jonas's bill and Senator Bill. One was in the Senate, one was in the House. Neither one of them were a bell-to-bell ban. Both of them got watered down from what they were originally introduced to as the course of the session went. This was always going to be an issue for our administration. But when you get sworn in December 15th and the legislature meets January 6th, you have some issues you want to take on right away and some issues you just know are going to have to wait to the interim. This was always going to be an interim issue. And then, you know, we started talking to people. This is one of those weird things where the data tells you the same thing you see anecdotally. The data says our K-12 kids have more anxiety, more mental health issues. Bullying, being a 12-year-old always was tough, but at least you had to be in the same room before for somebody to bully you. Now you can be bullied without ever leaving your house. Teachers want it. I said this, and I stole this line from somebody, and parents wanted teachers to do it. Teachers wanted principals to do it. Principals wanted school boards to do it. School boards wanted the legislature to do it, so we decided to do it. And we brought it up late. We brought both bill sponsors in. We got huge buy-in from both chambers. Nobody cared about the credit. Everybody just recognized that we shouldn't wait 2 years to do this. And so we moved it forward. So it'll go into effect in August. We didn't micromanage how schools deal with it. Some schools have kids drive to CTE, and we want to promote that. I mean, if you're using your cell phone to take pictures of taking apart carburetor that you're putting back together, have at it. But in the main buildings from bell to bell, we're gonna make those phone-free zones, and we're gonna want kids doing what we're doing, having a conversation, making eye contact. It's just, again, it's one of those things, you know what the data says, but you also see it through a weird, weird set of circumstances. When the bill was being reconsidered on the Senate floor, we were down at 48s, and they have a bell-to-bell ban, and we were in the lunchroom. And, you know, you have those circle tables, and there's eight kids sitting around it, and they're laughing, and they're talking, and they're probably doing too much. And then you go to a school that doesn't have it, and you walk into a lunchroom, it's pretty quiet in that lunchroom, and nobody's really communicating with each other.
Okay. How involved were you during the session? I mean, are you actually lobbying for things, or are you sitting back kind of watching and just waiting for bills to come out?
I watch very little floor session. I would get what you would call FOMO, fear of missing out. As somebody who served in the Senate, served in the legislative process, we made a conscious effort to weigh in on things that, you know, when the governor's office weighs in on absolutely everything, then where does it move the needle? So we spent a lot of time with a lot of different people on property tax. I think we absolutely drove the speed in which we got the cell phone bill through, but that was only because we had legislators on both sides of the chamber that were all in to help. And then, you know, when we're dealing with budgets and we're dealing with programs, I mean, State Hospital and stuff like that, I have a really talented staff that really want to work hard. They don't care about credit. They don't want to step on legislators, but we stayed in touch with them for a lot on different issues, but I didn't weigh in publicly on very many issues. We had an open door policy. Any legislator from either chamber, either party, can come down and see us anytime they want. They utilized it. We want to make sure that they know that we're part of this process, and we want to be a part of this process. So use the veto pen 4 times, and thought those, I mean, obviously none of those were overridden, so we were pretty comfortable with that at that point.
Of course, you just came from D.C. last year and sitting in your first year as governor. What about the tariffs that now are being thrown around and in place? How are they going to impact North Dakota and especially North Dakota farmers?
I mean, we'll wait and see. So I ran for Congress in 2018 when China put retaliatory tariffs on soybeans under the first Trump administration. And, you know, shortly thereafter, we ended up having better trade with China, less corrupt practices. You know, tariffs are one barrier to entry, but, you know, we always talk talk about tariffs here, but the VAT tax in the EU is really detrimental to North Dakota. But I don't think you can sugarcoat the fact that North Dakota is a commodity-based economy. We sell oil, natural gas, and ag products, and we don't want, I mean, you can talk to any North Dakota farmer that exists. We don't want more programs. We want access to markets. So we've been through this before. As we work through this, if we come out with better trade deals, then it was a good thing. If we end up in 36-month struggle where we're seeing real depressed prices because we're losing access to markets, then they're going to have, I mean, our friends in Washington are going to have to figure out how we continue to have the safest, most secure food supply in the history of the world.
Energy is a big thing in North Dakota, obviously. So how did the energy regulation bills fare this session, and can you update us on that?
So we talked about our state of the state, making sure that we had capacity for moving natural gas out of the Bakken. I think for as valuable as natural gas is to the state budget, it's almost, it can cause us problems. And the reason being is you want to be able to get that 10% off of a barrel of oil that goes into our tax coffers with significantly more than a 10% off an MCF of gas. So we've always known we have to have takeaway out of the Bakken. The Industrial Commission budget has $100 million of line of credit, which is in order for us to buy capacity. The problem with these pipeline projects is they take a long time to build. They're expensive to build. So you have to have end-use contracts in order to get it. And, you know, I would like to see this pipeline all the way to Fargo, but that last mile in Cass County can't get laid until that first mile gets laid in Williams or Dunn or McKenzie County. And so we like the way that looked. It also has the added benefit to, you know, every one of these communities from the western part of the state to the eastern part of the state, big or small, two things you need, whether it's for value-added ag or attracting industry, whether it's a data center or any of those things, you need power and you need water. And we can provide that power and get that product out of the bucket.
Yeah. So with all that said, and of course, North Dakota's economy, how is it positioned coming out of the session going forward?
I think it's positioned really well. I think we're excited about trying to get back into some of the base budgeting in the agencies and figure out how we can, you know, flatten out the growth in government and make sure that we don't get overly bureaucratic. But, you know, weird things, like I've never thought the cold and the wind was one of our best selling attributes, except if you're trying to build a data center. The cold and the wind are really good attributes. We have the right business climate, we have the right fiber layout, and we have the right energy climate, and the actual right climate. And so we have real opportunities, I think, to lead the way in some of this emerging technology that also utilizes our two best resources. Agrisso is going to come into Grand Forks, which is a potato processing plant. Great for economic development in that area. Really great for our Red River Valley farmers. Still staying true to what we do, which is value-added agriculture, and I think we're really positioned in a great spot.
Do you think the legislature is fine meeting every 2 years, or do you ever foresee a change in that and meeting every year?
Earlier in the interview, I told you that each and every legislator has more autonomy and authority than any legislative body. I don't know how you'd do 1,000 bills in an annual session. We're constitutionally mandated that you can only do 80 days every 2 years. I think the problem with annual sessions is there's no way to do it without capping bills or not allowing every bill a floor vote. And I think that if you decide you have to have annual sessions, I don't know how you could possibly, and this isn't as the governor, this is somebody who served there, right? Like I've been in that process. And I would caution my legislative colleagues to not lose what makes North Dakota special. And if you're going to have annual sessions, I don't know how you would do it without capping bills or figuring out a different way to time manage bills. And there's no way you can possibly do that without galvanizing more power in committee leadership or legislative leadership.
Yeah. If there's one or two things you could change magically, is there anything?
One, I think they should just listen to me whenever I tell them to do something. I absolutely do not believe that. It's a magically change. You know, everything about democracy is messy, but I don't believe that there's any other better way to do it. I think North Dakota, for as crazy it is and as many headlines as it gets, you know, they forget about all the good work going on a DOT budget or on a water commission budget. I think having more interaction in the interim, which we magically can change, turns out, between the legislative committees and the executive branch committees that they're working on, we need each other to create efficiencies. Like, I could do efficiencies in all my agencies without the legislature. Like, we could do that. They're my agencies. They're part of the cabinet. But the way to do it well is to get buy-in from the legislators, because next session we're going to have to come with some thoughts and some concerns about that. So I think it's a great process. I think that it could always work better. I think anytime you change the process, you are taking control away from one group and giving it to another group. And I think you have to really think about how that works.
We only have about 30 seconds left. What's the best thing about being governor of North Dakota?
The meetings start when I say they start. Everybody in the Capitol is getting used to meetings starting on time, and it's fantastic. The best part's people. Easter egg rolls in the front lawn, getting to go watch Fantasia at, or Anastasia, not Fantasia, at BSC, crashing fourth grade classes as they're doing a tour of the Capitol, grabbing a bunch of people, having them come down, take pictures in the governor's office. That's the best part. You get to see North Dakotans every single day and promote the heck out of this place.
Governor, if people want more information, where can they go?
You know, any North Dakota website we deal with, Armstrong ND, that's where we run everything on Facebook, and we have official, unofficial. It's, if you can't find us, then we'll talk to our comms people, make sure it's out there more.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having us.
That was Prairie Public's CEO John Harris with North Dakota Governor Kelly Armstrong. It was an excerpt from an interview that aired on the Prairie Pulse television show, which is a public affairs show that airs weekly on Prairie Public. It features long-form studio interviews with regional newsmakers, artists, politicians, and authors.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Martin Media, bringing Paula Poundstone, comic and regular panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, to the Fargo Theater on Friday, May 30th. Tickets and information at paulapoundstone.com.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 12th. The North Dakota Badlands have much to offer visitors and travelers if cultivated into a national park, proclaimed Delta R. Connolly on this date in 1927 to readers of the Hedinger County Herald. The North Dakota Federated Clubs had adopted a resolution at their 1926 convention to give loyal support to converting the Badlands into the Roosevelt National Park. The natural beauty of the region and its rich ranching history, including the impact the area had on former President Theodore Roosevelt, are among the many reasons the area is so special and perfect for national park status. Club members were urged, if they had not already done so, to visit this natural wonderland found within their own state and to share its beauty with others. Plans for a national park in the Badlands continued into 1930 when Governor Schaefer directed Phelps Wyman of Milwaukee to create a preliminary park study of the region. At the end of that report, Wyman made several recommendations for converting the Badlands into a national park. Among them, building a highway to connect the Badlands to new railways and highways, establishing hotels and recreation centers within the park connected by more primitive trails, and restoring the region's wildlife. Like the club members of 1927, Wyman urged leaders to preserve the natural beauty and spirit of the Little Missouri Badlands by transforming it into a national park. Not everyone supported the idea. In 1947, the National Parks Association wrote that the region being considered for the park at the time was not superlative nor unique to warrant national park status. Despite these objections, the bill to establish the park, sponsored by Congressman William Lemke, moved forward. At the dedication of the Theodore Roosevelt National Park in 1949, there was much to celebrate. The rich history of ranching, the legacy of Theodore Roosevelt, and the wildlife of the region go hand in hand with the unique geography that makes the Badlands so remarkable. As one speaker put it, every continent has its Badlands, but no other Badlands have the beauty of color added to the beauty of form as have the Badlands of the Little Missouri. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Ashley Thronson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
The U.S. backed off its trade war with China for 90 days.
After productive talks in Geneva, both sides now agreed to reduce the tariffs imposed.
The U.S. and China reset tariffs almost back to where they were before President Trump's Liberation Day. So what did the U.S. gain from weeks of chaos? On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for this Monday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll visit with St. Mary Central High School senior Yasmina Shimchak. She's headed to Villanova University this fall, and she's a parishioner at Cathedral of the Holy Spirit in Bismarck. We'll ask her what she thinks the election of an American Pope means to a younger generation of North Dakotans. Plus, she's also editor-in-chief of the school newspaper. We'll also ask her what's on the minds of high school students here in the state. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.